right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams, and we have been going at it hot and heavy since the beginning of the show. And, you know, Sandy and I have been kind of tinkering around the edges of this conversation for a while now, and based on, you know, what Lindsey Graham has said, if you're just joining us, basically threatening our government of some horrible things that will happen if Donald Trump, you know, winds up being charged with anything, that there's some ugly things that are going to happen in this country. He's not alone. Donald Trump himself continues to echo the same sentiment that, you know, there's going to be some horrible things that are going to happen if anything happens to him. And my pushback on all of it to Sandy, again, a tier one attorney, is how can our laws withstand threats from inside of it, and how can our nation remain the most powerful nation on the earth, and the oldest democracy on the earth, if when the democracy is challenged, which is what's taking place right now, a challenge to the democracy. And the democracy almost appears to kind of wither and shake.
Well, I don't think it can survive unless the norms that are expected.
But Sandy, you just out of your mouth, and that's amazing to me. You don't think that democracy can stand under that kind of scrutiny?
Democracy can't stand unless there are norms. The norm of the rule of law is accepted by the populace, and the rule of law is implemented without force, primarily, okay? The force has to be there as a potential, but it doesn't have to be exercised very often in the circumstance in which the norms are honored by the general. So it has to do with the value system in the country. And what will save our country is if we can awaken our value system and get it to look more broadly at the value of the American community, to get a community value-based system, or a community-based value system. And instead of where we currently are going, which is this fragmentation and this us against them, where a substantial number of the people view us as the people and them as the government. And so, you know, we are headed in a very perilous direction where norms are being flaunted, norms are being questioned, norms are being ignored. Leaders like Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump are attacking the norms and suggesting that the people would and will rise up against the imposition of the rule of law to the extent that it is running contrary to their view of what they think the law ought to be.
So, Sandy, if these people who feel that way, let's say by some miracle, Republicans don't retake the House, Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the presidency for another 2 years. Republicans then don't win the presidency in 2024. Doesn't have to be Donald Trump. Does that mean people are still angry they don't get their way? You still got to be worried about them because they didn't get their way?
It's not so much about getting their way anymore. I think it has to do with this fear of us and them, and the them are these unpatriotic liberals who are tearing apart the country, which is really premised on this tribalistic view of what the country is and what it should be. I just think that it's a basic value problem we've got, and until that value system gets corrected, it won't matter who's in office, because whoever controls the government will be them, and whoever doesn't control them will be us, and they'll be victims. And the question is, what kind of recourse do the victims want to take? The progressive people who viewed themselves as victims wanted a social revolution that was going to be politically generated. The conservative populace seems to be more interested in taking hold of government in a much more forceful way. Their version of revolution involves something that apparently can look like January 6th.
You know, Sandy, values. Where do values come from, right? Values are different based on the household you grow up in, right?
I mean, they come from the communities as we grow up. Our first community is our family.
Right.
Then our community becomes our schools and our churches and our village, our locality, our neighborhood. Then it becomes the general, much more commonplace that we exist in, our workplace, or what have you. But values are imbued by that process. And the American value system is just much different today than it was even at the time of Richard Nixon, obviously, because the reaction to Watergate and the reaction today is much, much different. It's much different than it was, I think, in our youth. The American, the individualism that is a part of Americanism has taken hold in and has essentially defeated the community as a primary value in America.
You know, Sandy, you would say, and I said this before we went to break, we can say it now. Is it safe to say that maybe religion, as we know it, could come in, enter into this, and maybe that's the only way that we can avoid, you know, what's going on. Maybe the appeal from the religious community to Americans that, listen, we've got
to. Well, it needs to be a religious community that is not itself divisive. We need to find a religious community that doesn't want to attack LGBTQ plus. We need to find a religious community that doesn't want politics to fixate on what bathroom people can use. And we need it to focus on important fundamental values. And I think the problem is that, I think in some respects, there is a notion out there that I share that some of the religious movement in America has actually fostered tribalism rather than defeating it.
You know, Sandy, we got the right young man that we're going to bring into the conversation, and that's Connor. So Connor, you've been listening to the conversation that Sandy and I have had now for the better part of an hour and 45 minutes, almost 2 hours.
Yeah, about 2 hours.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on a young guy like you seeing all of this? What are your thoughts?
It's so difficult, and you guys have touched on a lot of separate things, you know, from racism to international politics to now we're talking about tribalism. So, but it is all connected. Like, it is all a part of the same us versus them mentality that Sandy's been harping on, and that being the root of the destruction of our discourse and such. It's very difficult, or not difficult, but interesting to hear it from you guys' perspective, because in hear Sandy describe the development of values being as a trace of, or as a nexus, stemming from the way that you go throughout life, right? The different communities that you're a part of. You have family first, and you go out, and you have education, and you have the workforce. But to me, and I think this is just fundamental to how America works, like, because in other countries, their, let's say, cultural norms are built out of a very, very long history, and there's lots of culture, and there's lots of politics that are intertwined with culture that create that I think ultimately make it so people, let's say, in a Scandinavian country, are more comfortable with their government taking more aspects and being more responsible for separate aspects of their life. But in America, we basically, like, the entire idea of us to become economically dependent or independent
right.
is by trying to go from separate community to separate community. You know, you're trying to you go to work and you go to school and you go to like you have all these separate parts in life where you go away from what you know and you go to a separate community. And I think that at the core, right? I mean that's the individualism that's baked into the notion of our
nation
of our nation exactly
yeah.
or the philosophy of our nation. I think because we live in such a globalized age, it's reaching this point to where, like, they can't coexist simultaneously, right? or they have to coexist.
Well, what's interesting, though, you is know, that de Tocqueville, this French historian, philosopher who traveled America in 1825 to the mid-1830s and came out with a book in 1835, his nutshell analysis of America was that American individualism was going to defeat our sense of community, and that that individualism had some qualities to it that could take America to high levels, but that ultimately this loss of sense of community could be a real problem for us. And wow, how prescient was that? I mean,
accurate that was.
Yeah, because that's really where we're at. Yeah. I mean, what you just identified, Connor, is exactly that, which is we've got this powerful sense of individualism, which does take us a long way. It creates a great deal of reliance, maybe entrepreneurship, maybe innovation, but it also divides us and makes us unwilling to commit to the community as the superior, as a value that is superior to each one of us.
Yeah, and I think it's also as a consequence just of the historical ramifications that created America, because like I think a fundamental value in a genuine society should be compassion, and I think a person that decides to become entrepreneurial or decides to lead a certain thing or create a community should be driven out of them trying to maximize, like in a utilitarian sense, like trying to maximize happiness for as many people, right, that they want to maximize as much as possible, right? But in our current system, you could gain tons of success and tons of economic and commercial viability and not have that be your intention whatsoever. And if any party, if any agency or if any critic, so to speak, were to try to criticize you for lacking that compassion or understanding as a value in your operation, then you can just either purchase, let's say if you become as big as a company like Amazon, purchase the media instruments they use to control the narrative, or just continue to eat it, or just continue to make, you know, to make profit, as long as you have, you know, satisfiable investors and such.
And once again, Connor, I think you've hit a nail on the head there, because it is true, I think, that many entrepreneurs, people who start small businesses that grow to be relatively big businesses, where they know all their employees, you know, they've got 700 employees or 2,000 employees, but they're all situated in Milwaukee, and it's owned by a small cadre of people, and they all know their workers, much the way A.O. Smith was when you started working for Earl. That's a different environment. The owners actually care for their workers, but when the ownership gets to the point where the workers are just an obscure force of people, they're just a cost input that they have to evaluate, like it became with Amazon. Amazon undoubtedly started out in a warehouse with Bezos sending out books and having all this stuff, and I'm sure
Sandy, we're going to break right
okay,
now.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
got to go to a break. Yeah. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, there's a shortage in our military, and the shortage is not, you know, financial. It's not that there's not enough money there inside of it, but there's a shortage of young men and young women who want to become foot soldiers. And I don't know. It's no surprise that our deeply troubled nation is plagued by multiple health crises, but it can't find enough military recruits. And you know, there was a time not so long ago that Americans would want to see their young people sign up, right? It was a badge of honor. Mothers, suburban mothers, would certainly want their children to join the military. It was an honor to have your child in the military. It's almost like your child being in college. You would say to people, well, my son is in the military, and the people would acknowledge, well, that's great. That's great. But I don't think anymore, Sandy, that's not the case anymore. What happened to many American people who felt it an honor for their children to serve in the United States Armed Forces?
Well, now I've got mixed feelings about this because I personally believe we ought to have national service like most of the rest of the world
right,
has
so do
for
I.
all young people.
17
and,
years
and
old.
I think that would be part of our developing our sense of community and our sense of risk, a shared risk, shared opportunities, and shared obligations. And so we would share the risk of military activity in a much more equal manner, right?
Yeah.
And so I've never been a very strong supporter of the voluntary military because I think it has separated our military thinking and concept from the general public. And it's been possible to view our military like we do the Packers, right? We don't all play for the Packers, but we all sure want them to win, and it sure is great if you can be a member of the Packers, and so you know I got military friends. I'm not sure I view it as a problem that we're having trouble getting volunteers for it because I'm not sure that people should want to be in the military, but I think people should be willing to be in the military when they're called, and I think that the military should only be deployed for the most principled and most important government purposes, the real interests of America. So, have we done that always? No. I mean, I think that the deployment to Afghanistan at its initial stage might have been for a principled purpose, but 2 years later and then 20 years later, not so much. And Iraq was clearly a question. And these question marks began most fundamentally in Vietnam, even though they should have existed before that, mm-hmm. with our South American activities. Here we are. We read today that we have 900 soldiers in Syria, some involved in combat. Who knew?
No, I know.
And so, you know, I get the skepticism about, and I'm sort of glad that people aren't championing their kids into the American Army, but I think what we ought to have is national service, and we ought to have a standing army. We need one. But we ought to have one that's configured that looks and smells and is just like America and Americans. And so what you're telling me isn't bad news. You presented it like it could be. To me, it's not. And I think what we need to have is broad national service. And if everyone doesn't go in the military, they might go into the Forest Service. We might find other ways for them to serve the government, just as happens in Norway and Sweden and Finland and Israel and France and all over.
So this is where have all the soldiers gone? Military shortage is about America's dysfunction. The American military is now having trouble recruiting enough soldiers, according to the New York Times. Its ranks are short thousands of entry-level troops, and it's on track to face the worst recruitment crisis since the Vietnam War ended.
Connor, who is the age of people who might go in the military, was going to have something to say.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was just going to ask Sandy, Wendy, do you think that this general service or just national service should be something we should reform our systems first and then implement this system, or do you think that we should implement, let's say, national general service first and then reform?
Well, I think the two would go hand in hand. In order to implement it, you'd have to reform things.
Yeah.
You'd have to figure out how these people in national service would be deployed, and I don't think they should be deployed in a way that hurts long-term labor force, but they could be deployed in a way that carries out things that, much like the CCC did during the Depression, they could work in parks, they could work in various kinds of national service in addition to the military.
And Sandy, it happens in other nations.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, so
yeah.
it is a tried and true situation that already occurs.
Well, and to be honest with you, in that process, people do get trained, if only in some of the basics of work, right?
They learn discipline.
Well, they learn discipline. The national service does involve a very disciplined approach to whatever it is that people are being called upon to do. Some people will learn skills. It will defer their entry into the job. They will get paid something for it so that they will know they will not be a dependent, and they will ultimately emerge into the workforce a little later in their lives, which creates a more full employment environment, and they will emerge with better training.
All right, listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. Do it, do it. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, you asked me about the, what's the name of the...
The Artemis. Yeah, the Artemis launch.
I like that name, man.
Artemis.
Artemis. It's been scrapped. And I just wanted to ask you, 50 years ago, there was a man walking on the moon. A couple of them. 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The technology that sent them to the moon... you would think was archaic. The technology we have in these phones almost supersedes.
Yeah, in fact, I think on September 7th, the iPhone meeting, the one where Cook always has this special staged, I think he's going to announce that the iPhone's going to the moon.
Oh.
No. He's not going to announce that.
No, Sandy, but my point is, the technology that's in the iPhone you have supersedes probably some of the technology.
Well, there's no question that certainly the computer-based technology and the remote control technology and everything is substantially enhanced. I just don't know the extent to which thruster rockets and the whole technology associated with that has been enhanced. I think it has, because now we're hearing about hypersonic missiles that go much, much faster than the ones that we had before. In fact, Russia's announced their capacity to fire these hypersonic missiles and has done so in Ukraine, I think. But I was interested today and yesterday. I was reading the Wall Street Journal Weekend, and today I was listening, and they were featuring the notion that the Artemis launch was a big test for Boeing. And, I don't remember ever hearing about who it was, but obviously the rockets back then were also built by a private business contracted for by the government. And it turns out, to my interest, that the thrust rockets in this one are built by Boeing, and the rest of it is basically Lockheed Martin. So it's basically this military-industrial complex that's highly involved with NASA in a multi-billion dollar. I think the Artemis, the cost for it is $3 billion when you amortize the development costs, and for this first rocket, it's $3.5 billion or some such number.
Sandy, you and I were around 50 years ago, and the last time man walked on the moon. And we remember automobiles 50 years ago. Take a look at your automobile you have now. And the technology that's in it.
Yes.
And you go back to what the automobile was 50 years ago.
Well, the automobile still has the same thruster. More or less. Still got pistons and cylinders, and it's got fuel injection now that's more sophisticated than the carburetors were.
The steering and everything about them
has been enhanced.
Yeah.
And the computer has definitely caused the cockpit to have a much more information in it than we had before.
They're much safer. The steering, the suspension, all of those things, light years from 50 years ago when...
Well, and they are much more economical. They burn much less fuel.
Right. And a lot lighter, a lot safer. But my point is, 50 years ago, we were on the moon. And yet, with all of our advancement in technology, they're being meticulous about this flight. They're going to around the moon. They're not going to Mars. I could understand going to Mars, Sandy, but why so meticulous about this? And maybe it's because of all the money that's lined up down the road.
I think it's because of the reason I said. I think that the vendors, and NASA too, a failure will put a political dent in NASA's ability to keep asking for all this funding to carry out the projects. And the vendors, Boeing and Lockheed Martin, want to make sure it's a success because it's now being talked about in Congress that this is a Boeing rocket. And this is on top of the fact that the Starship rocket of several years ago was a Boeing rocket that failed, and on top of the Dreamliner fiasco that they had. So Boeing is talking publicly about the fact that this is an important technological test to prove their capabilities. Better that it not be launched for a couple of days and get to the moon and around it than that it fail on the way. So I'm sure that there's lots of people saying, no, we're going to be very careful with this launch.
Yeah, and you could see long term, because they're talking about, you know, jumping back and forth up to the moon and preparing, you know, a spot where there's inhabitation of the moon. And then even longer term down the road, Mars and all those things. And all of it is predicated on whether or not this thing successfully.
Yeah, I wonder. I just realized this could be a solution. We could, if the American public could nominate the people that they want to send to the moon. There's some people. There's definitely some people that I would nominate. Where everyone would be better off if they just went to the moon, and then we could talk about the man in the moon.
You know, Sandy. They're talking about inhabiting Mars, and there's plans in the works, and that have been in the works for some time, for, you know, not just Americans, but the people of the Earth inhabiting Mars. You gotta get to inhabiting the moon first, and before you even think about inhabiting Mars. And you would think, Sandy, that by now They would be real close. I mean, the space station and what they're doing there, they prepared themselves already. We don't know all the things and experiments that they've been doing on the space station, but, you know, I think about
incidentally, you know who was running the space station?
Russia. I know.
And so, you know, there was a period.
But are we still working with them on that?
Well, we just had the last Americans come back from the space station. I think it continues to be inhabited by Russians. And I think there's a question mark as to whether Russia and America will continue to cooperate. But that's another example of the frayed situation that America has participated in terms of creating this fraying of relationships with what is clearly another important, very sophisticated.
But we still have trade with Russia.
We do have some trade.
Yeah. I mean, some. I mean, not as much as we used to.
Well, with the sanctions, right. I think we have almost no trade. But this isolation, we can talk about that later, another day. But the isolationism that's developing, this deglobalization, has some very horrific prospects for the American economy and the American people. It's a mixed curse or a mixed blessing, and I think it comes much closer to being a mixed curse.
You know, Sandy, I was, part of me wanted to see this move forward after 50 years, and I remember the debates on whether or not what happened 50 years ago really happened. You know, people ask questions. Hey, you believe that happened? I said, well, why you ask?
You mean the moon landing?
Yeah, and the guy says, and I said, well, yeah, I do. And he says, did you ever wonder who had the camera that took the shot of it flying away once it left the moon? How did it get from the moon, you know, take off, and they've got.
Did they have a? Was there a camera view of the takeoff?
Yeah.
Oh.
even Connors.
Oh. Oh God.
Yeah. And you're talking 50 years ago.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
He had the camera.
How did they have a camera back then? Like,
oh, you're asking how they have cameras?
No, I was being sarcastic because it's like,
I know, yeah.
Bro, it's a camera. Like, they had cameras in the 60s.
Yeah, I know, but
all they had to do is have it parked on a tripod when you think, oh, but then
how did it get back?
It had to get sent back.
Yeah.
Well, we had radio, and we had...
they had radios.
And we had... They were telecasting the image coming back, so they just had to have a memory in it, or they had to... I don't... you are asking...
Well, the other part
you mean
of it...
Matt Damon didn't really get around Mars?
You know, the other part of it is, you know... There are people who have legitimate questions to ask about certain things that make you stop and say, you know. And so the one guy who asked me that made me, because I argue, yeah, we were there. Yeah, I believe we were there. And,
yeah, but those same people asking, how do we know that the computers that counted the votes in 2020.
Yeah. Really?
I mean, yeah, you can probably boil every single conspiracy theory down to certain people.
Certain questions.
Just certain small questions. Yeah. And
the
they just build.
One pregnant question.
All right, we got to go through a break. No, we got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, we got like 3 minutes.
Okay, so.
I'm the break guy.
Yeah, okay. So.
Yeah, you don't decide these things, Earl.
Well,
Connor decides, and
it's good to know that he's there because I would have had us going to a break 4 minutes early.
Good to know that somebody
I mean, hey, if you want me to play
charge.
Stevie Wonder for the rest of the time, I'm perfectly fine.
You know, Sandy, but again, the moon, you would think the moon is right there. You know, we can certainly get there. We know a lot about it.
I do believe in exploration. I do think that the space exploration brought us lots of things. There is a cost-benefit analysis we should do. We should definitely do a cost-benefit analysis on our defense expenditures. But I think on any big expenditures, until we get the American public, with a view that the American government is providing on what they need and want, we've got a problem. And so all these other things we talk about, it's good entertainment, it's a lot of interesting stuff. But if we don't re-triage the way we spend money and the way we focus our attention, getting back to the problem we spent the first 2.5 hours talking about, we aren't going to solve that problem. So I think that I cheer it. But on the other hand, I think, wow, the many billions of dollars we're spending there on top of the close to $60 billion in Ukraine now already at the blink of an eye, and this $800 billion on defense, and still we don't have an American public that feels its government is providing what it needs or wants. We don't get child daycare. We don't get education all the way up through. We don't have a community interest that has the people believing that the health and through a healthcare system and the education through the education system is an asset for the community, and it's not just a handout to people. Here we think those things are handouts. In most countries of the world, they believe those are investments by the community interest in a value that will return value to the community.
So, Sandy, do you think that this could be one of those rallying points that the nation is looking for where... You know, people can all stop and say, like, back in those days when the rockets went to the moon and Alan Shepard flew around the first...
I mean, maybe. In the Olympic years, when the U.S. is getting gold medals like mad in the Olympics, does that unify America enough?
No, but I do remember back during Alan Shepard's time, first man in outer space and those kind of things, it rallied the people. They were able to build that into it. I don't know if they can do that anymore.
I think they did, but it was also because we were in a race. We were.
I got to go to a break. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Yeah.
Once in my life, it's gonna feel real good, gonna make a difference. it's gonna make it right. As I turned up the collarbone, my favorite winter coat, this wind is blowing my mind. I see the kids in the street with not enough to eat. Who am I to be blind, pretending not to see their need? A son has disregarded a broken bottle top and a one-man soul.
And the lyrics.
They follow each other on the wind, you know, cause they got nowhere to go. That's why I want you to know. I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. And no message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then
you
make
know,
a change.
You know. I let Connor kind of have his way. I just get out of the way and let him do that. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, Adam Kinzinger, Republicans in real trouble because we have no leadership. Adam Kinzinger.
Sounds like me there, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's a bright, bright man. And he calls it straight. And he sees that.
See, I mean, if people follow the norms, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney, these people, you don't agree with them. Part of our democracy is people have different views of the paths our government ought to take, and we vote, you know, it's like a parliamentary process. But ultimately, they believe in the country and the rule of law, and that's fundamental. And they have been ostracized by their political party because all they've been standing up for is the norms.
You know, Sandy, this has to grade on Republicans right now. They've got to be looking in the mirror. Speaking of Michael Jackson looking in the mirror, they've kind of messed this up. They were in a position to take over the House, possibly the Senate. Normally, based on things that are happening, it was their time. And they did, you know, the Supreme Court move on Roe versus Wade.
Well, you know, I think this is going to be a strange metaphor, but this is all about picking your bedfellows. And if you get in bed with the wrong people, bad things can happen. And the Dixiecrats, the Democrats were in power for a long time, but they were an odd consortium of northern and southern people. And the Southern Dixiecrat was not made up of labor union workers. It was made up of the Southern establishment. It was the people in the South who are now Republicans were Democrats. They were the Dixiecrats. And it was the Dixiecrats that turned the other cheek and looked the other direction for Jim Crow laws and let all that happen. And the Dixiecrats were in control essentially from Roosevelt through to Lyndon Johnson. And then Lyndon Johnson fractured the Dixiecrats by having the civil rights laws that were basically formulated through the Democratic Party and the portion of the South, the Dixie portion of the Crats, bolted from the Republican parties and got in bed with the Democratic Party and got in bed with the Republicans. The Republicans have two wings. They have the Northeast establishment Republicans who are the norms, people who follow the norms, and we have the Southern Republicans who are newcomers who began to embrace ideological conservatism in a very strong way, carried states' rights. Dixiecrats had stood for states' rights to some extent. Southern Republicans jumped on that wagon fiercely. And so now we've got the bedfellows, the strange bedfellows exist on the Republican side. And we've got Adam Kinzinger and Liz, a bunch of people who are fundamentally the establishment Republicans. Barry Goldwater was actually an establishment Republican. He was fighting against the Nelson Rockefeller wing, but the Republican Party at that point were all basically establishmentarians. And it wasn't really until Newt Gingrich took the Republican Party and recognized what all its elements could be and how they could be played like an orchestra to achieve great power. And so they did, but it was with strange bedfellows. And then the Tea Party became even a more difficult bedfellow, and one that basically, from the bed, basically made it so uncomfortable for everyone else that it started taking control by demonstrating how a minority could control the process. And so I think it all has to do with that.
You know, Sandy, Newt Gingrich was ostracized for a while after his time from the Republican Party, and kind of you didn't get to hear much from him for a long time. But if you watch the evolution of it historically in recent history from the Tea Party to where it is now, I thought the Tea Party was... But those people were nothing like...
Well, you know, Newt Gingrich was a party person, okay? So he believed in the Republican Party. What's happened now is it's turned into a cult. I'm sure he is now and has written about this. Now it is not. It has deviated from being a party, and now it's a cult. And it's a personality cult driven by Donald Trump. So it's no longer what a Newt Gingrich had wanted to be, because he had fundamental principles. We disagreed with them. We didn't like them. Right. But he had principles that he wanted to install. The new Republican Party just wants power. And they don't have a principled base that's related to it.
You know, Sandy, when you refer to them as a cult, that's pretty demeaning to some, but they can't argue that, can they?
Well, I don't need people to agree. I just think that when you look at it from a distance, you can say that it has deviated from being a set of principled ideological purposes, and now the purpose is power, and the power is to be exercised.
At all costs.
The power is to be achieved at all costs, and it is to be exercised essentially against the government.
All right, that's it, Sandy. Thank you very much, as always. Thank everybody who made the show go. Connor, thank you, as always. We'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned in to the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.